SIS 301, spring semester 2009. This is lecture lit 5 on Jean-Jacques Rousseau. We've been moving steadily through the European Enlightenment, did Hobbes and Locke in the past two sessions, and now, logically, it's time for us to start talking about Rousseau, who is an important guy when it comes to a number of these things. We are, of course, skipping over some people. There are some other folks in here who are kind of important, people like David Hume and, Hume is the one who immediately leaps to mind as somebody who's particularly important that we need, probably should have spent a little bit of time with. But I'm going to talk about Hume as a setup for talking about Kant next week. So for today, I just basically want to focus a little bit on Rousseau. And the reason why I'm doing this, the reason why we're skipping over a number of people and focusing on certain others, is precisely because, if you remember back to the very beginning of the course, the selection of readings here from classical political philosophy is not simply some kind of classical political canon, right? This is not a class primarily on the Enlightenment or on the development of European political thought. This is a class about international relations theory. And so the reason for selecting and focusing on the particular people that I've chosen to focus on is because these are folks who then will get picked up and redeployed in later IR debates. Hobbes and Locke, this is very much the case with. See, IR scholars in the 20th century, and we're going to see this in a few weeks when we actually move into the 20th century, actually take their descriptions of the state of nature from classical European political thinkers, particularly from Hobbes and Locke. They take their description of the state of nature from them and then apply that to the international realm. Hobbes is, of course, preferred by self-identified realists within IR. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short is sort of the way IR realists like to describe the relationship between states under anarchy, which justifies spending a lot of money on defense budgets and trying to protect yourself from the inevitable encroachments by your neighbors in a military way. Now, as we've talked about, this is not actually Hobbes' theory of IR, but this is Hobbes' account of the state of nature. And that gets taken by later scholars and sort of ported into the international realm. Similarly, self-identified IR liberals, or neoliberals, and if you know anything about IR theory, you'll understand neoliberalism in an IR theory sense. If not, tune back in a few weeks, and then you'll hear IR theory, neoliberal IR theory in its particular sense. I will be talking about that when we read that relevant stuff in a couple of weeks. But the point is that their state of nature is an awful lot more like Locke's, which is to say, it's not a great place to be, but it's not the worst place either. There's a lot of stuff that exists. There's a lot of problems involving people acting as partial judges in their own cases, and it's difficult to conclude agreements, and so on and so forth. But it's certainly not as dangerous as the Hobbesian state of nature, and therefore international relations for a liberal is not as dangerous, and therefore not as inevitably militarized or inevitably conflictual as it is for a realist. And so this is why these two start to become important, because they get taken up in this kind of partialized way by later IR scholars. Now, they have ripped these descriptions completely out of context. If you think a little bit about how nuanced the account of the state of nature in Hobbes and Locke actually is, the idea that one could simply take a description of the state of nature, which is, after all, a state of relations between individual persons, and somehow import that wholesale into the relation between sovereign territorial states should strike you as a little bit odd. Yeah, and it should strike you as a little odd because it is a little bit odd. And there are specific historical reasons for this, right? There are particular reasons involving the history of the discipline and the ways in which certain kinds of political sensibilities grew up to become international relations. Basically, what you end up with, I'm going to talk about this a little more in a few weeks, but I'll just foreshadow for right now, your classical realist tradition really came out of a series of historians who were kind of schooled in realpolitik, and for them, Hobbes was just a description of the way things were, so they, of course, kept that. Liberals, a little more optimistic, were very interested in sets of commercial relations and how that could actually lead to some kind of peaceful, positive transformation of things. And Locke is generally their philosopher of choice, or one of their philosophers of choice. So you end up, in fact, technically the philosopher of choice for them is probably more John Stuart Mill than Locke. But anyway, that's a nuance we'll get to a little bit later on. Point being that folks who were doing IR did not consider themselves to be doing political theory. They saw no particular need to have a great amount of fidelity to these classic complicated texts. And so instead what they did is they simply took the parts that seemed to them to illuminate their subject matter. And in particular, what they took was the notion of the state of nature. Now, as we have talked about a little bit, and as we will continue to talk about with Rousseau, the status of the state of nature is a little unclear in liberal thought, particularly social contract liberal thought, which is what we've been focusing on the last few weeks here. They all have a state of nature, but it's a little unclear exactly what the state of nature is. I mean, is it an imaginative construct? Is the state of nature a hypothetical that these authors come up with in order to envision what life might have been or probably was like at some unspecified time before human beings were gathered up into societies? Or is the state of nature something that actually concretely exists? And the authors are kind of undecided on this, because they'll talk about it as being imaginative, and they'll talk about it as being hypothetical, and then they'll give empirical examples. Either examples of when the state of nature did exist, or examples of its continued persistence, or in the example that Hobbes and Locke, and as we'll see, Rousseau, are also very fond of, the state of nature that exists in that place outside of Europe over there in the New World where people are still running around like savages. So there's something kind of unusual going on here, because on the one hand it's imaginative, on the other hand it's supposed to be empirical. Both of these threads can be seen running through these authors' discussions of these things. Now, the character or the status of the state of nature may be unclear, but the function of the state of nature in liberal thought, in liberal social contract thought, is much, much clearer. Because the status of the state of nature is, in a way, to guarantee the non-arbitrary character of social arrangements. By which I mean, the importance of the state of nature to these arguments is that all of these authors say, having uncovered the state of nature, this then gives us a set of puzzles for the governance of human beings, which problems that are given somehow in human nature and in the nature of human beings together. The rawest, most pure form of human sociality is what's supposed to be in the state of nature, because you have stripped away all of the accoutrements of society, everything of civilization, technology, all of this stuff is gone, and you end up with this core, and this core set of principles about human beings and the ways in which they relate to each other. If you can reach that point, the bet seems to be in all of these kinds of arguments, then you can find a secure basis on which to build a form of governance which will be non-arbitrary, will not be simply set up to enrich various power holders, but is in fact founded on something that is true and absolute. That seems to be the goal in all of these state of nature arguments. Whether anybody's actually reached that goal is a whole separate question, right? Whether anyone's actually gotten down to that kind of base level, or whether, as later critics will often charge, state of nature theorists have read their preferred version of what they either think society should be like, or what they think is useful for their argument about what society should be like, back into something called the state of nature. So it's a little odd that sometimes the state of nature looks an awful lot like the kinds of social relations that the authors are looking around and seeing actually empirically in front of them. Usually not the case with Rousseau. Rousseau is one of the more anthropological of these folks, and so he goes back and really tries to reconstruct this. He has these strange appendices, and in the Discourse on Inequality, for instance, he has this whole strange discussion in a footnote about whether human beings ever walked on all fours, using what was, at the time, contemporary anthropological evidence about these things. So it's very odd. It's a very weird way of organizing things, because especially for our modern sensibilities, right? Because we don't tend to think that government is founded on some absolute pre-social state, right? We tend to derive our understandings of government from someplace other than some posited pre-social existence of the human being and human sociality as such. So this whole style of argumentation is sort of not current anymore in a lot of ways, but we still have its institutional legacy. We live in its institutional legacy. Particularly in the United States, we live in its institutional legacy. For reasons I'll talk about a little bit more, or I'll illustrate that a little bit more. For now, realize another interesting thing about the state of nature and state of nature arguments. The state of nature represents the past, right? So contemporary arrangements in all of these folks, these are improvements on the state of nature. They're ways of solving certain kinds of deficiencies that are inherent in the natural state. They're ways of making things better than they would be left to their own devices. However, the state of nature also represents a state of perfect freedom. There are no social constraints. There are no limitations on what you can do. Right? Think about Hobbes. In the state of nature, you have liberty to everything. Right? So it's absolute perfect freedom. There's nothing stopping you. Now, of course, for Hobbes, the fact that there's nothing stopping you also means there's nothing stopping the other guy who's next to you, who's bigger than you are, so you're going to get killed. So that's a problem. But the point is that the state of nature, even in Hobbes, is still a state of perfect freedom. Similarly in Locke, the state of nature is a condition in which, okay, you have to live under God's law, but because you're a partial judge in your own case and you sort of follow the dictates of your own reason, you basically have no constraints, except the ones that you generate for yourself. No constraints are generated from outside and imposed on you in the state of nature. So in that way, the state of nature represents something to be improved on, but it also represents the perfect freedom and liberty that individuals might have and experience. Those two dimensions, right, freedom versus progress, this sort of tension, this weighing of these two together, is central to the dilemmas of liberal thinking. Is the cost of entering society worth it? Or is it better for us simply to remain in the state of nature? For Hobbes, the answer is an unequivocal yes. Yes, it's worth it. It's very much worth it. For Locke, government's good for a bunch of stuff. Don't live in the government. Might be a little inconvenient, but it's a little bit harder to tell. Locke still, in the end, kind of throws his hat in the idea of, no, we still actually need a government, but it's a little less imperative than it is in Hobbes. Rousseau, as we'll see, is much more ambiguous about this, or at least much more resigned to certain inevitable costs and inevitable degeneration that comes with living in society, living in a commonwealth. That freedom versus progress dichotomy, that tension runs all through Enlightenment thinking, where on the one hand you have a celebration of the future or the present and moving on into the future and the improvements we're going to have, but then there's an awareness of a certain loss, and trying to figure out what to do with that loss versus the promise of progress is a big overarching meta theme that runs through a lot of these folks as they try to reason their way through this. Now, there's Rousseau. And I want to talk just briefly about an earlier book of Rousseau's that we're not reading for this class. If this class were a lot longer, we probably would read it, because it's a fascinating read. But in fact, if this class were 2 weeks longer, we would read Discourse on Inequality 1 week, then we would read Hume's Inquiry into the Principles of Morals, and then we would read Rousseau's Social Contract. But we're not going to do that. So instead, I want to just very briefly mention this earlier work of Rousseau's, which is actually the thing that made him famous. This was a prize-winning essay that he wrote on the question of inequality, and it was about inequality and the naturalness of inequality. And Rousseau's basic thesis in the Discourse on Inequality is that inequality is not natural, that everybody by nature is equal, but in fact inequality is a social product. It is socially produced, it is socially maintained, its benefits and its detriments are entirely social and cannot be traced back to some kind of natural state. So this is in many ways a diatribe against notions of natural slavery, against the idea of natural inferiority and superiority, and it's kind of a dangerous thing to be writing in Europe in the mid-18th century, early 18th century, when you still have, kings floating around, and nobility, and the whole idea that sort of people are born to better stations simply by accidents of their birth. And Rousseau says, not really. Inequality, not actually given in nature. Inequality is actually a social product. Rousseau, in the course of making this argument, fleshes out a specific kind of state of nature, which is a state of absolute perfect freedom. Individuals can do whatever they want. doesn't inevitably lead to the kinds of clashes that Hobbes had in mind, even freer in many ways than Locke, because there's no God-given law that your reason tells you about in nature. In fact, in nature, you're just a savage. There's not really much reason at all in the sort of broader sense. So, for Rousseau, the state of nature is perfect freedom, perfect equality. It's entering society that kind of messes everything up in some ways by producing inequality and producing oppression and producing, well, the main motor for Rousseau is actually the production of property, which Rousseau says is what actually produces inequality in a lot of ways. The state of nature for Rousseau is also peaceful. It's peaceful because of a natural sympathy. And parenthetically, I'll talk about this next week more, but parenthetically, this is something that he kind of derives from or derives in parallel to David Hume. Hume famously argues that that the foundation of morality is a natural sympathy that individuals have with one another. Right? I have sympathy with my fellow human beings, therefore I can project myself into their shoes, therefore I don't want to unnecessarily hurt them, so on and so forth. For Rousseau, natural sympathy is a powerful force in the state of nature, and that natural sympathy leads to a certain kind of sociality and a certain kind of pleasantness of the sort that Rousseau thought that he and others had observed in the non-European, quote-unquote, uncivilized peoples of the New World. The natural sympathy is destroyed by the entry into society and is replaced by various other kinds of vices and virtues. So that natural sympathy, the power of that natural sympathy, only really operates outside of society in the state of nature. So you would think, given all of this, that Rousseau might be very much opposed to society and to social life. And he certainly has a few bad things to say about it. There's a whole series of appendices in The Discourse on Inequality, and footnotes and such, and just past patches where he starts ranting about things, sort of rants about how effeminate, and this is the terminology that he uses, how effeminate and weak modern man has become, you know, because man no longer grows his own food and hunts for his dinner and so on, and all these skills that savages had have been lost, and all this greatness of spirit has sort of disappeared and been replaced by very petty kinds of concerns with manners and society and all this kind of stuff. So social life imprisons man, takes away, strips man of all of his, and it's mostly him for Rousseau. There's more gendered language in Rousseau than in anybody we've read since Machiavelli, and there's very much this kind of opposition about male and female and masculine and feminine qualities. So social life imprisons man and strips him of his strength and so on and so forth. But, and here's the interesting thing in Rousseau. But, for all that, social life also perfects human beings. Social life opens possibilities for human beings to use their reason to discover virtue and to live lives of moral duty and do good things, allows them to engage in industry, allows them to engage in science, allows them to do a whole bunch of things that they would not otherwise be able to do. So social life, even though it has these costs, social life perfects man. And so Rousseau says at one point in The Discourse on Inequality, if you, my readers, are really concerned about this and you really want to go back to the state of nature, then you're welcome to go out and try living with the bears in the woods and see how far that gets you. For my part, I'm going to stay here because I know that there's no going back. The journey out of the state of nature is a one-way journey. And once you're out of it, you're out of it. State of nature's gone. We now have to live with what we have and with what we've built. That is Rousseau's starting point. We have to start where we are, rather than starting where we once might have been. It's a little different than what we find in Hobbes and Locke. Now, I mentioned how Hobbes and Locke were basically appropriated by different international relations theorists. And they were. They were appropriated by international relations theorists. Especially their states of nature were kind of taken in. Rousseau, on the other hand, Rousseau is not usually that popular as a state of nature theorist. Not in IR, anyway. Nobody goes and grabs Rousseau's state of nature and kind of uses that to try to talk about international relations. Ken Waltz did at one point, an early book in 1959 called Man, the State, and War, actually attempted to use a Rousseauian understanding of the dilemmas of cooperation between independent units. What is it called? The Stag Hunt Paradox. Has to do with the idea that if you have a bunch of individuals sitting around the state of nature, and if they all cooperate, they can get the stag. But if any one of them defects, the stag's going to get away, but then that person might be able to grab a rabbit. So the problem in this particular setup is people won't cooperate to get the big thing because they think they can just get the little thing on their own. So everybody's kind of collectively worse off than they otherwise would be because they don't all collaborate to get the stag. So yeah, so there have been some attempts to use certain elements of Rousseau's state of nature, but not anywhere near as systematically. And in fact, Rousseau is not usually on the IR reading lists in a lot of ways, which is too bad, because Rousseau has a lot of very interesting things to say. Particularly since, if we run a little thought experiment here, if people did use Rousseau's state of nature to try to think about what was going on in world politics, what might they take? Well, Rousseau's state of nature, remember, is all about how social relations and relations of inequality and hierarchy are not natural. They are, in fact, produced by social actions. They are, to coin a phrase, socially constructed. So they're not natural, right? But they are produced, and they have specific histories as to how they were produced. Another thing that might be people might take is that in order for individuals to get together and do things, you probably saw this in the social contract as well, and I'll talk about this a little bit in a second, right? Individuals actually need to consent on things in order to produce social arrangements. Individuals have to at least tacitly buy into them in some way, right? Which is a general thing in liberal thought, but Rousseau really pushes this in some interesting directions. So, but if you took these two things and sort of created an account of the state of nature that you that would then try to use to interrogate the international system, if you did this, what would it look like? Well, what you would end up with is what is currently called constructivism, or something very close to it within IR. You'd end up with something that's sort of the liberal variety of constructivism. Lots of tacit consent, lots of social construction, lots of ideas that are important with putting relations together, and so on and so forth. Interestingly, though, for reasons having more to do with how state of nature arguments have kind of fallen into disfavor, you don't get an awful lot of that among IR constructivists. They don't tend to go back to Rousseau and pick up Rousseau's state of nature. But if they did, they might find some interesting allies if they were interested in trying to have a picture of the state of nature that would be rooted in classical philosophy. There may be other reasons why, especially liberal constructivists, don't really do this, but I'm going to wait a few weeks till we've read a little liberal constructivism to talk about this. For now, realize that Rousseau is sort of an underrepresented member of this particular philosophical tradition when it comes to contemporary IR resonance. And it's too bad, because Rousseau has a lot of interesting things to say about relations between independently constituted polities. But if Rousseau is kind of underrepresented in IR theory, Rousseau is certainly not underrepresented in discussions of politics. Rousseau is usually blamed for the French Revolution, pretty much straight up. People blame the French Revolution on Rousseau, which is sort of a bizarre, if you think about it for a second, think about the counterfactual here. If Rousseau hadn't written what he wrote, somehow the French Revolution wouldn't have happened. That's a lot of weight to lay on one essayist, right? To lay on one guy's writings. Because when people blame Rousseau, they blame Rousseau's writings. They don't blame, you know, Rousseau's rather notorious affairs with all and sundry, including young women he was tutoring, and so on and so forth. That's not generally what they blame the French Revolution on. They blame the French Revolution on things Rousseau said and things Rousseau wrote. Right? So that's kind of the direction of causality here. What do they blame in particular? Well, they say, hey, the people, when the people started uprising there in the end of the 18th century, they were claiming that they were sovereign. They were claiming that the people were sovereign. And there's a phrase like that in Rousseau. There's a lot of phrases like that in Rousseau about the sovereignty of the whole people. And so Rousseau, they must have read Rousseau, and Rousseau must be to blame for this. Right? So that's one line of causation. Another one, as you see in the social contract, when Rousseau starts talking about the general will, right? The general will can't be opposed. If the general will dictates something for a group, then that's pretty much it. That's how it goes. The general will is it. The general will is the last word in a lot of ways. And if the general will says that the king has to be beheaded, then hey, I guess the king has to be beheaded. Now, this is a rather sloppy reading of Rousseau, actually, but this is the argument, the charge people often levy against Rousseau when trying to blame Rousseau for the French Revolution. I think it's important to distinguish between efficient and permissive causes when we try to talk about any kind of great historical event like the French Revolution. The permissive causes of an event, right, maybe the sort of long-term shifts in constellations and configurations of social forces that made an event possible. And it's entirely possible that Rousseau's thought did do something with that, with shaking up some ground and maybe stimulating people to think about things in particular different ways. But as an efficient cause, regardless of how it gets romanticized, one does not have a particularly good historical consciousness if one thinks that people are going in, having a fierce debate about the discourse on inequality, and then going out and storming the Bastille. That's just not... The line between philosophy and action is much more complicated than that. Particularly the line between somewhat abstruse philosophy like Rousseau's and direct, concrete political action. I'm going to say not an awful lot of people who are floating around actually perpetrating the French Revolution either had their copies of Rousseau in the pocket or weren't necessarily all that up on being able to debate the finer points of Rousseau versus other governmental theorists of the day. So as an efficient cause, I don't think that argument works. As a permissive cause, it's entirely possible. But it's hard to sort out Rousseau as permissive cause from the general current of liberal thought, which prioritizes and privileges the people, and says that it's the people who really rule, and it's the people who are in charge, and the people actually have to design and designate the government. And that is the, I think, the more important background shaping effect here. So not Rousseau in particular. There's another kind of line, though, that we could trace, which would be not Rousseau to the French Revolution, which is sort of standard, everybody does that. Interestingly, I think we could also trace some elements of Rousseau showing up in the American Revolution, or at least in the American Constitution that comes after it. Now, usually this is understood to be Locke's show. The textual parallels, Thomas Jefferson's obvious affection for Locke and borrowing certain phrases from Locke, the fact that Locke was the second most read and cited and referenced source in early America, going by letters and so on and so forth. So Locke is huge. Locke is huge within there. And usually people sort of look at the American Revolution and say, oh yeah, well, this is kind of Locke's show, right? You know, life, liberty, property, happiness. You know, so that's kind of the way people will generally do it. But this is, and while this is not entirely unrevealing, there's an awful lot of Lockean stuff, like what Joshua Foa Deanstock has referred to as a Lockean sympathy in early American thought. It's not entirely conclusive. There's some other stuff going around in the design of the early American Republic, the design of the American Constitution, which certainly suggests some kinds of parallels with Rousseau rather than parallels with Locke. Let me give you a few examples. Right, there's a few aspects of the U.S. Constitution that really have a hard time fitting with Locke's understanding of individuals coming together, joining into a commonwealth, alienating their executive power, the law of nature, up to the legislature, which then decides by majority rule what's going to happen, and primarily protects people's property. Right, so that's the basic Lockean, in many ways, the basic Lockean scaffolding. Right, there's some stuff in the U.S. Constitution that doesn't quite fit this picture. For instance, the Constitution is written in the name of we the people, not we the property holders, not we the individuals who were given our property by God, not we the reasonable. It's we the people, collective noun, the people as a whole, which sounds a little out of place with Locke's extreme emphasis on individuals as the origin of everything. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the Constitution which, and you see this also in the Federalist Papers, which are in some ways designed to elucidate the U.S. Constitution, there's a whole lot of stuff going on there which is the opposition to factions, organized groups of people who are agitating against the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Now, that's kind of odd in, if you think about that in a Lockean term, right? Because for Locke, individual groups that would be campaigning against the permanent and aggregate interests of things just doesn't make an awful lot of sense. Why would there be such things? And of course, what you would do, well, because everybody's reasonable, then everybody would know that you have to sort of go along with the laws, and if it's just a question of partiality, then you're going to sort of come down. That's what the military's for. You come down and, you know, push them back in their place. But this idea that there would be permanent groups that would, like, disagree about what things, what direction the community as a whole should take, and that the groups that opposed the permanent interests of the community would actually be factions, would be somehow non-representative. That's weird. Because in Locke, a bunch of individuals getting together, if they were campaigning for something, well, they would be like a political party or something. But in the U.S. Constitution, there aren't any political parties. Instead, groups that are agitating for some particular cause are usually denigrated. In order to get anything changed in the U.S. Constitution, you need a giant supermajority, right? You need a huge amount of things. You need 3/4 of the states, or you need giant majorities of both the House and the Senate. There's a whole bunch of different ways to do this. Senators in the original Constitution aren't even directly elected. Right, you have the Electoral College to basically put a check on the people. The only thing that people get to vote for directly is the House of Representatives. There's all these barriers to direct popular will, which make little sense in Locke, because in Locke, it's individuals, interests, representation. Should be pretty easy. Why all these layers? Why all these mediations? Which sounds a little more like Rousseau, if you think about it. There's ways in which there's something very Rousseauian about trusting the people in the aggregate, but distrusting the people in an individual case, and trying to design processes to get from individual cases to the people as a whole, or the general will. The Supreme Court, when Locke starts talking about the three powers, the judiciary isn't even in there, right? The judiciary doesn't have a huge role to play within a Lockean conception of things. The judiciary has a huge role to play within Rousseau, though he doesn't always call them the judiciary. He'll alternately refer to them sometimes as the censors and sometimes as tribunals and so on. The idea being that there's somebody there who's supposed to defend the Constitution. That's a weird position within Locke, because within Locke, everybody's simply representing interests. No one's defending something called the interests of the whole. In fact, in Locke, there's no constitution. Right? There's no moment where we the people come together and actually declare what's supposed to be the case, and then somehow we keep referring back to that. That doesn't seem to be the sense of what Locke has in mind. He doesn't talk about that. Whereas for Rousseau, this is exactly the idea. This is exactly the idea in some ways, that the people would come together and, like, figure out what they were doing. And then, in the interim time before the people got around to coming back together again, somebody else would help to defend that. So there's a very, very unlucky and very Rousseauian aspects of what goes on in the United States. Note, I'm not trying to claim any direct influence here. I'm not trying to say that there's a direct causal connection between these things. But I do think that there's an intriguing parallel that might be worth exploring or thinking about. All right. So what does Rousseau actually do in this book, The Discourse on Inequality? Well, the basic puzzle, as he tells you right up front, is to try to find a way to preserve the perfect liberty of the state of nature under the inevitable conditions of social existence. People exist in society. We no longer exist in the state of nature. Because we no longer exist in the state of nature, we have to find some way to preserve liberty, thus rendering our current social arrangements legitimate. That Rousseau sets up as his puzzle. He does use some historical examples, but largely this is a logical argument. This is largely an argument based on a certain series of abstractions from basic principles. This is not primarily about history. There are some empirics, but this is, again, primarily a logical or philosophical argument. He does try to anticipate objections all the time. He has that great footnote at one point where he says, "All my ideas are true and consistent, but I can't get them all out at once." Rousseau, not a person who suffered from any shortage of ego when it came to his own ideas, or to his own, shall we say, conquests. But Rousseau always tries to anticipate objections, so he tries to create an argument that really is airtight, that anticipates what people are going to say in response and tries to provide an answer in advance. He's also much more sensitive than some of the other folks we've read to the role of non-state institutions. You have the Commonwealth, you have the society, people come together and form it. Everybody else, and Hobbes and Locke, have been really focused on the government, per se. Machiavelli is very focused on the prince or on the government. If you're dealing with republics, you're not focused on a prince, obviously. Everybody's been focused on the official folks. For Rousseau, there's other stuff that goes on in here. There's a lot of other non-state institutions that are responsible for helping to maintain order and ensure legitimacy. So he's much more concerned about some of those things, and there's areas there we can probably explore. All right, a few questions to ponder as you read this text. You know, Rousseau says he wants to preserve perfect liberty, but his solution involves the general will, and the general will can force people to do stuff. The general will can remake things and push things in particular directions. So has he succeeded? Has he succeeded in figuring out a way people can remain free, and how can that be the case if the general will can force them to do things? A second question. Is the general will any different than public opinion? Or are these actually the same thing? Does Rousseau have in mind something like a governance by permanent opinion poll? Or does Rousseau mean something else? And that's an important kind of question, particularly since people who do public opinion work will often say that public opinion is about measuring the general will. Or they won't use that exact phrase. They'll say we're measuring the opinion of everybody or the opinion of the whole or something. That, I think, is an open question, and that's something we should probably spend a little bit of time discussing, whether governance by public opinion poll or focus group is what Rousseau has in mind for his general will-based system. Now, Rousseau's general will stops at the level of an individual community. So you kind of have to ask yourself, could there be anything larger? You have to ask yourself that because it's an IR theory class, right? So we have to think about the whole planet and everybody on the planet. Could there be a global general will? Could there be a regional general will? Could there be some set of principles that people agree to which supersede the principles that they agreed to within their own little individual polity? Right, that's an interesting question. Could there be a global general will, or does the general will always stop at the level of the nation or the state or the community or whatever? Right? Or would there be procedures for moving the general will up? Would it even be a good idea to move the general will up and have a global general will? And finally, Rousseau goes through a whole series of fairly elaborate ways of trying to put this system together. You gotta ask yourself, would this actually work? I mean, would this actually work? Would the people ever actually be able to come together as a whole and do the sorts of things that Rousseau insists that they're able to do? Is this actually feasible at all? And that's, I think, something that we could equally ask of Locke and of Hobbes, and we did that a little bit, and have done that a little bit in class discussion. But I think particularly when it comes to Rousseau, who makes these fairly grandiose claims about having preserved states of perfect freedom even under conditions of social inequality and connection, I think it's even more important that we ask whether this would actually work. All right, enough to think about for now.